House Committee on Revenue will come to order for Tuesday, February 5th, 2008. It is the time for organizational meeting, and before we actually get started, let me greet one newcomer and one member in a new position. First, let me introduce our new member, the new member of the Oregon House of Representatives, Representative Cliff Vance from, and Representative, would you like to take a minute, sort of introduce yourself if you want to, and describe your district a little bit, and then we'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, my district is District 60, which is the four counties of Harney County, Malheur County, Baker County, and the empty part of Grant County. And there are supposed to be 57,000 people in it, but I'm not sure that's really true. But I'm very happy to be here following Representative Butler's footsteps, which is going to be very difficult. I'm fortunate I have a modest background in law and estate planning, but not anything like you folks have been dealing with. We're very simple-minded in Eastern Oregon and very straightforward. The legislation I've seen so far seems to be much more complex. But I look forward to listening and learning. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. And I did warn you, that you were going to get into this mess. And when you get back to your law practice, you will have learned a whole new complex area, mm-hmm. if you didn't already know it. We appreciate very much your being here and recognize that it's not an easy chore to kind of jump in the middle when we've already done months of planning for the session. Thank you very much for joining the committee and being available to be helpful. The other announcement I want to make is that, as you're aware, the Speaker has appointed a long-standing member, Representative Vicki Berger, to be our new Vice Chair, and I'm very pleased to welcome Vicki into that role. Thank you very much. And with that, I'd like to open a work session on the adoption of committee rules. Paul?
Mr. Chair, you have the standard House Committee rules, the draft rules in front of you. These are the same as the other House committees. There aren't any exceptions. The only thing I'll just remind you of is you can have a public hearing, public testimony without a quorum, and that sometimes will come up. And the other distinction to keep in mind is between a subcommittee and a work group. A work group is an informal group that doesn't require public notice or cannot make decisions about bills. A subcommittee is like a smaller version of the actual committee and has to follow all the committee rules. So that sometimes comes up.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the House Committee on Revenue Rules.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the adoption of the rules as printed. Is there any discussion? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the rules as printed? I don't see that either. Thank you very much. With that, the rules are adopted. Discussion work plan. Paul?
Mr. Chair, so we're kind of between or looking at a scaled down version of our regular procedures, and so we did put together discussions with the chair a committee work plan for you, and that's in front of you. I don't think there's anything that we haven't really talked about in the period leading up to the February session. To remind you of the bills that you will have assigned to the committee. I have them listed there, and really looking at this in three segments, the first being your first order of business is a consideration of the House bills, and we have some background material that will hopefully help you in that discussion this week. But the bills are 3618, 3619, 3620, and 3621. These are all bills that were requested to be drafted by the House Revenue Committee. So those are all concepts you're familiar with. We do have the date until Tuesday, February 12th, to take action on those bills. So that's kind of the time frame we're working within. Technically, the House Revenue Committee is exempt from those formal deadlines because oftentimes the nature of the business you do, sometimes particularly in relationship to the budget, may require later action. But I know the chair is committed to taking action on as much as feasible.
Well, you might note that if we don't take action by the time that other committees do, they might adjourn before we get the bills to the floor. It's important for us to try to stick to the deadlines if we can.
And we don't want to slow that process.
Well, we sure don't.
The other segment then would be the bills that come over to you from the Senate. There is some uncertainty there because the Senate had a little different process than you did in the House. We do have three bills I've listed there that were requested and actually introduced by the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. I have those listed. I will remind you that on the Reconnect, we have two versions right now of an identical bill. 3621 and 1081 are the same bill, but the thought is that 3621 would give you some flexibility if you decide it's appropriate to take action in response to what the federal government does. We know the Senate appears to be on its way to adopting a stimulus package today. Their version is different than what the House approved. So we may see in the next couple of weeks something for you to potentially respond to if Congress takes action in time and the President agrees. So that's kind of it. So the 3621 is seen as a backup, really. The 1081 is a connection to the 123107. The other thing I should add is that the senators had authority to submit one bill on an individual basis, and we have several of those in Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. So you may see one or more of those bills come over as well. The third segment of the work plan, and this has been made very clear by the Speaker's office, that if the committee is able to complete work on the bills for the February session while you're still participating in the session, to go ahead and begin or continue working on your interim plans, interim topics, and on the back of your work plan, we've listed those that are part of the work plan that we're hoping to spend some time with. The first is on tax compliance efforts. We do have a bill actually in Senate Finance and Revenue that directs the Department of Revenue to come up with some recommendations to improve tax compliance, so that would be part of that general discussion if that bill comes over. We also and we have several committee members who are on the Comprehensive Revenue Restructure Task Force, an update on those activities. Hoping to find a time when the chair of that task force would be able to come and talk with you. Another issue that is being discussed at length in the Transportation Committee, and the governor is working on proposals on transportation funding and begin to look at some of those options from a revenue standpoint. Another issue we've had a lot of interest in is links between tax policy and environmental policy. We've seen it on the credit side in terms of the Betsy, but also in terms of potential other ways to affect the environment through use of the tax system. So if we have some time, we have some issues to discuss there. The corporate minimum tax alternatives is part of your interim work plan. We know there are proposals being developed, and to the extent we can give you some background on that, we would spend some time with that. And finally, we have interim activities that we've been involved in, directed by statute, such as study of enterprise zones, small schools, and then, of course, the county timber payments and what update the counties can give us on what's going on in that local revenue area. So that's the work plan that we're looking at.
Any questions or comments about the work plan that we ought to talk about now? We have been through all of this stuff before, but it's a little bit more concrete at this point. Paul, do you want to comment a bit on our tentative schedule?
Yes, I put together just, this is really an informal fluid document. It's one that we normally do on a regular basis, but just to give you a sense of kind of what we're looking at out there, and I emphasize that it is tentative, and as you know, things don't always tend to fit into our little schedules. So you can anticipate changes, but just to kind of give you a sense overall of what the next 4 weeks may look like, we have today we're posted for your organization and also some background information we have for you on the business energy tax credits and the estate tax. Some further background, we have a presentation for you by Solar World, who's a major company who's invested in Oregon, who is considering investment in a number of operations. And there will give a presentation to us tomorrow. We have some further background on the estate tax. And then, as the chair mentioned, on Wednesday, we have scheduled a meeting Wednesday night for a public hearing on the three major bills that you have, 3619, 3618, and 3621. So we will set that public hearing so that you have ample time for discussion of those bills. On Thursday, we have asked the treasurer to come, and he's agreed, along with his debt manager, to talk about debt policy and bond capacity. The overall debt policy commission has issued a report, and they're going to go through that with you. And then you also have a bill that you requested for introduction, which is House Bill 3620, that looks at the Oregon Growth Account and expands the reporting requirements that are in current statute. So that bill would be as part of that discussion. On Thursday night, we've reserved that time, or just kind of a warning that how things go. If you need that time, we wanted to reserve that to make sure we've got the flexibility to go ahead and continue work on 3618 and 19. Those bills are the Business Energy Tax Credit Bill and the Natural Resources State Tax Credit Bill. We anticipate those to be the most complicated bills, so we put those in there, so if you need that further time. And then on on Friday, we have the March forecast sped up 3 weeks for purposes of giving you time to react to that in the February session. Will be released, the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will join you here in this room for the release of the forecast at our regular meeting time at 10 o'clock. Then next week, we've just scheduled and anticipated that the House bills will require work sessions Monday, possibly Tuesday as well, since the 12th is your deadline. And then I just began to list some of the Senate bills we anticipate coming over, just to kind of fill in the schedule. I've listed the other fund revenue forecast. One of the things that we think, especially Mazin and I, that we don't put enough attention on these other revenue items that are not general fund and lottery. And we do require, as part of the forecast process, every 6 months an update on those revenue items. The biggest one relates to a key area that you'll be talking about alternatives, and that's transportation. Mm-hmm. So there is a formal gas tax, weight mile tax forecast that comes out. And so we thought it might be helpful to have that as kind of a follow-on to your Friday general fund lottery forecast. Again, time permitting. And then also I've plugged in the tax compliance and administration discussion there around Senate Bill 1082, which is the Senate bill that directs the department to make some recommendations improving tax compliance. The bill there that I didn't list on the worksheet is Senate Bill 1101. That's just anticipating that it will come over. That bill calls for some clarifications to the real estate withholding requirements from the that you approved last session for non-residents. So there were some issues that were still out there in terms of exactly how that's to be administered. And the financial services industry has been working with the Department of Revenue, and they've submitted this proposal through Senator Cruz.
So is that in the Senate committee?
Yes, that bill has been assigned to the Senate committee, and they have actually posted that for a hearing and possible work session for both Wednesday and Friday.
Is it possible we're going to have that bill by then?
It's possible, yes. It's also, they have the same deadline in terms of taking action on Senate bills as you do on House bills. So if they're going to take action on it, the last day that they would have would have time to do that would be Monday, the 11th. It still may not be across the floor and into your committee by that time. But again, that's more or less to give you a sense of the universe and what's out there. And as I say, there's some other Senate bills too that may well come to you as well. I've just listed that one because that's one that both committees I know are familiar with.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I worked on this somewhat during the interim myself. Department of Revenue, as you recall, last session we had this bill on out-of-state real estate sales and the tax compliance with that. The Department of Revenue had some trouble around writing rules. If you recall, the financial services folks had some real problems with saying, I don't think you can even do it this way. I think they came to agreement on a way that we can get there, and this represents that, I hope. I would have submitted this had I had a bill to submit. I did not. Senator Cruz was willing to, and I think that Senator Burdick has been, I've had discussions with her about it. So it's quite likely it'll come our way, I hope, because I think we do need clarification here.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum, did you have something?
Well, no, only I don't want to take up any more of our time about the schedule, but that nightmare is probably the word that occurs to me most frequently about schedule these days. And these evening hearings do conflict with other hearings that some of us are chairing, for instance. So I would just ask that if work sessions and votes on bills are going to happen in some of these places, we really need to know about it, because I know that Representative Berger and I are, for instance, Wednesday night on a task force on the joint state hospital committee that will be meeting simultaneously.
What I'm hoping that we'll do is work out some of the likely issues on these bills in these evening meetings, but actually have our work session on Monday. And that would give you a chance to get an idea of what the potential amendments are to look at over the weekend. And I apologize for not being able to get this done faster in the time during the day, but I think the two of these bills at least are complex enough so that it's unlikely that we're going to be able to do it that way.
Right.
And I appreciate the concern. One other concern I have as we're talking about this is that I think that at least a couple of our meetings next week are likely to be preempted by all-day sessions on the floor. If I recall the schedule correctly, I think it's Wednesday and Thursday. We're scheduled on the floor the whole day to work on bills. Now, I may be misremembering it, but that's my recollection. It's possible that these schedules are going to have to be a little bit flexible, that moves around. Do you have other things on the schedule now?
Just to add on the schedule, Mr. Chair, that the Wednesday evening for the public hearing, we are committed to that. We posted that. We may well have some people from out of town and so forth. So
this week.
Yes.
Yes.
That's a definite. On Thursday, we have not. We've made it clear in the schedule that it's on an if needed basis. So that'll be kind of at the discretion of the chair and the committee as to kind of where we are in terms of those bills.
Representative Rosenbaum, you and Representative Berger may be playing catch up a bit on that public hearing piece, and we'll do the very best we can to keep you informed of what transpires in those meetings.
And if it's possible that informational presentations happen when everybody's not available versus real testimony. Obviously, work sessions, you want everybody available.
Correct.
But even for me, anyway, hearing public testimony on some of these bills is probably more important to me than hearing some informational presentations. So I know these schedules are set now up to a certain point.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Anything else on the schedule?
That's all we have on the schedule, and we will update this regularly as developments happen.
Right. So a portion of each meeting might very well be devoted to letting you know where we are on the future of the schedule. Why don't we move on to the information meeting?
Okay.
And I think you're leading that as well.
Actually, I have Chris, and I'll ask him to come up. One final thing, a logistical thing, Mr. Chair, is that, as you know, we are our temporary permanent offices are over at the what we call the annex, and but we do have what we call the outpost over here, which is in room 140C, which is right across from. A number of you are located in that Secretary of State area, so we're right across the hall from you. So it's right across the hall from Secretary of State's office. We plan to have someone there at all times. So if you need to track us down, that's a place to find us.
It's interesting. Legislative Revenue, Legislative Council has an outpost next door. Yes. And so we've almost got the Secretary of State surrounded, don't we?
The Secretary of State's gone.
Well, you don't still have an office.
We will have the Secretary of State tomorrow morning.
Yes.
Okay, good.
We have an outpost.
Chris, go ahead.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allen, Legislative Revenue Office. You should have in front of you a double-sided handout. In the first page entitled Betsy Preliminary Certifications.
Chris, we think your mic may not be close enough to your mouth. There.
Is that phone. Better? Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. You should have in front of you a five-page, two-sided handout with the first page Betsy Preliminary Certifications. And what I was going to do is just walk through some background information on Betsy and culminating with a discussion about some of the changes that were passed in the 07 session. So just by way of background, I guess, at a very high level, the way the credit works is that a company can come in and apply for a pre-certification, and from that time, they included in that is an estimate of the costs of the project that they're going to undertake. From within 3 years of that date is their deadline to complete the project, and then upon completing the project, they can apply for final certification. For the most part, the final certification occurs the year that the project is completed or within 3 years, but that isn't in statute. There is no statutory deadline of when that final certification comes in. So with that backdrop, that's kind of the two-stage application process. And then the credit itself is claimed over 5 years. And prior to 07, all of the credits were 35% credit of the certified costs, claimed in 10%, 10%, 5, 5, 5. And then in 2007, as you recall, part of the program was changed to a 50% credit for certain projects, as well as a maximum project cost increasing from $10 million to $20 million. And there were some other changes, but those were the two of the bigger ones. So the preliminary certification chart that you have in front of you goes from 1980 to 2007. 1980 is when the program began. And the way I've broken it down there is into the three main categories of project types. You have conservation projects, recycling projects, and then renewables projects. And over that time, you can see that it was fairly flat, under $50 million in certification costs. These aren't credits. These are the costs. And then starting in 2000, it started to pick up. And then within 2006 and 2007, it's really taken off, the pre-certifications. In 2007, for the first time, we had these renewable manufacturing facilities. Now, these are the facilities, as you recall, that actually produce, for example, solar panels. They actually produce the renewable energy as opposed to a project that uses renewable energy. And so while prior to 2000, some of those projects were contained in the data, the Department of Energy didn't really separate them out. They didn't have a separate category for them. They were lumped in with the renewables. So for 2007, that striped bar, that's the first year that they separated it out. And so that's why it just shows up in that 1 year. And so what we see is that between 2004 and 2007, the pre-certs grew from $150 million to $450 million. And that's even the $450 million in 2007, the amount of applications that the Department of Energy got was about $1.3 billion in applications. So there's a lot of uncertainty in how these will ultimately play out. And already from the start, over $1 billion in applications, but only less than half of that count makes it to the pre-certification stage for whatever reason. And then as we walk through this, you'll see that number falls down in terms of the amount of projects that ultimately make it to the final certification. But there obviously has been rapid growth in the past couple of years. So if you could turn the page to the final certifications. Now, this is a mirror chart showing the final certifications from 1980 through 2007 and the first month of January. And a couple of things stand out here that I want to point your attention to. The conservation has grown a lot since between 2002 and 2007. And that's driving up a lot of the use of the credits to begin with. And that was irrespective of the 2007 law changes. Those changes didn't affect the conservation programs at all. A couple of things here. In 2007, you see that the dip from 2006, it was about $175 million in final certs in 2006, down to about $150 million in 2007. And at the time, it was a little uncertain if that was an actual representing kind of a peak in these or if it was people holding off to see what would happen during the 2007 session. And in 2008, this is just 1 month of data, there's a number of conservation projects that have been certified. Now, some of that might be spillover that would have occurred in 2007 had this issue not been on the table. But that striped bar represents projects that are all but officially final, have all but received final official certification, official final certification. And a lot of these are waiting for a pass-through option. And as you know, the credits can be used by the taxpayer who's eligible for them, or they can transfer it to a taxpayer. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more, but that's how, and that's where a lot of the uncertainty currently lies, because there isn't a lot of liability for corporations to use these credits, and one of the appealing aspects to it is the ability to transfer the credit to other taxpayers. So right now, it's about $165 million that are sitting out there waiting for pass-through partners. And if you flip to the next page, there's kind of a two-stage pie chart that provides a little more detail on these pending final certifications. Now, these final certifications are just for projects that were completed in 2005 through 2007. So it is a subset of the data, and I'm talking to Energy on a daily basis to get more complete information, but I believe this is the bulk of what's in the pending, at least as at the end of January. But the Department of Energy, they are emphatic about how these numbers change on a daily basis as the certifications are processed and new projects come in. So that's why it's stated as of January 31st. And you see the total pending there is $165 million, and of that, the renewables account for $143 million. And most of that is for projects that were completed in 2007. And some of them were 2005 and 2006, and that's part of this lag aspect to the project. Now, the pending, the amount that's out there, the secondary market is a big issue, because as the number of certifications, we can see in the pre-certs and the final certs have been skyrocketing, they're going through the roof, there isn't generally enough liability on the part of the C corporations to use these, so the pass-through market has become a key player, if you will, in determining the ultimate use of these credits.
Excuse me, when you say liability, you mean tax liability.
Tax liability, yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And so there's this huge amount of the potential use of credits that are in the secondary market. So we've seen a huge run-up in the supply, so the question now is whether or not the demand side of that market can equal the supply. And if the demand, historically, it hasn't been there, but it's just recently that the pass-through has become very important. I mean, changes to the kicker affected the use of the pass-throughs. And the way this works in the secondary market is that a taxpayer who wants to transfer the credit sells it for a net present value. I'm just trying to look that up. I think it's 25% or somewhere in that neighborhood that it's sold. And so another taxpayer would buy that credit, and they would pay 25% of whatever the dollar amount of the credit was, and then they would claim it over 5 years. They have to maintain that same schedule. So one of the questions for taxpayers who want to buy the credit is whether or not they will have sufficient liability over the 5 years to fully utilize the credit. And the price that those are determined, that rate is not set in statute, but it is defined by rule. And the Department of Energy has the authority to set that rule. So we have this kind of a classic market situation where we have an oversupply of these credits in the secondary market. The demand demand side doesn't seem to be there to support buying all these credits, and then the price is relatively fixed. So unless that price changes, so if the energy can reduce that price, you might see an increase in demand and more of those credits being sold. The implication for the state is the more those credits get sold, the larger the revenue impact. Okay. If you could turn to the next page. There's some history on kind of the final stage, and these are the credits that actually show up on the tax returns. Now, we only have specific information for corporations, so these are just the C corporations that have been claiming the credit from 2000 to 2005. And a couple things stand out there. One is the huge uptake in 2005 from about 12 million claimed to about 26 million claimed. Now, within that bar in 2005, $26 million in credits were claimed, but only $20 million were used to offset tax liability. The remaining $6 million in credits will be carried forward. And the credit currently has an eight-year carry forward, so they can kind of linger. So everything on the tax return side is a mixed bag of current credits and older credits. Another point on here that affects the revenue impact, if you will, is in 2001, you can see that the amount of credits claimed was about $10 million, but the amount used was just about two or three, and that's basically recession year. Corporations didn't have the liability to use the credit, so more of them got carried forward. And as more of the credits get carried forward, eventually they will expire. But that kind of spreads out the revenue impact, as well as some of it not coming to fruition if they run out of time to use the liability.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I think I have it exactly wrong, and I'm really looking at this chart, Chris. The darker hashed is the unused that's carried forward.
Okay,
I think I have exactly wrong in my notes. Okay.
That's on the fourth page, is that right? That you're referring to?
Yeah.
Yes. Basically, yes.
Okay. Yeah. I think your labels are correct.
Yeah, I clearly was reading them wrong. Thank you. Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Chris, so as a practical matter, when you want to buy these credits or sell them, who do you go to?
The Department of Energy.
And they are actually marketing the tax credits to other taxpayers?
Well, the way it's set up, a taxpayer can come and claim the credit, and they can have their own pass-through partner set up. So they can go to the Department of Energy and kind of have that market already set up. But you can also contact the Department of Energy, and they have some staff who are trying to find some pass-through partners.
So it's sort of like a Match.com for...
I'm sure Mr. Graney would appreciate that analogy. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on that, Chris, did you say that the 25% is defined by rule, the price, essentially?
Yes. Yes.
Thanks.
And just to add to that, I investigated that issue yesterday. The way the statute is written, it appears that the Department of Energy picks a number, and that's the number. So that may be one of the issues we want to look at when the bill comes up. Please, go ahead.
Right. And yeah, and to add to that also, it's supposed to be the net present value of the credit claimed over the years. That's what the target price is. Now, so this is kind of in the chain going from application to pre-certification to tax return. This is kind of the end of the line in terms of what we'll see in terms of revenue impact. Now, historically, this is just C corporations. The piece that's missing here is on the personal side. And prior to 2005, we didn't have specific data from the tax. We couldn't look at the tax return in aggregate and see how many of the Betsy credits were claimed. Starting in 2005, the Department of Revenue made a change on the tax returns that enabled us to look at specific credits. Basically, there are, as you well know, there are a number of other credits, and on the tax return, there's a specific line that says other credits. You claim the amount that you have, and when looking at the tax return, that's all you can really see. You don't know exactly what it is. For audit purposes, the Department of Revenue can ask for further information. The change they made in 2005 was enabling up to, I think, three credits to be specifically identified on there. And so we're much more easily able to identify what constitutes this group of other credits. And in 2005, there were about $9.5 million in Betsy credits that were claimed, and just about $8 million that were used. So on the corporate side, the use of the credits has ranged from 50% to 75%. And on the personal side, the use is going to be much higher. Largely, I mean, that's the pass-through market, so presumably people are only buying the credit if they're fairly confident that they're going to use them. And the usage there we're seeing is in the neighborhood of 90%. And as I've talked to the Department of Energy in the past year, the pass-through market has come to represent about 50% of the credits that are out there, at least in terms of potential claimant, that not all of those have a pass-through partner set up currently. That's where it's still kind of in this limbo stage, and we're not really sure to what extent it will, those credits will be sold and then ultimately affect the revenue side.
Could we get that in a written form? What you just, I mean, there's about six sentences there that are very packed with data.
Okay.
It would be useful, I think, if we could get that in a written form at some point, recognizing they're all estimates.
Okay.
That would be helpful. Please, go ahead.
Sure. And then in 2006, I was just talking to the Department of Revenue on the corporate side, there still aren't any significant numbers with respect to Betsy. As you know, there's a significant lag in the data, as you're aware, in terms of corporations in the fiscal year and when they file and going for extension. So it can be toward the end of this year before we have solid 2006 data. As a matter of fact, the 2005 data just became finalized in December. On the personal side, the Department of Revenue is finalizing the 2006 data, and preliminary numbers coming out of there are that on the personal side, about $12 or $13 million in the Betsy credits were claimed. So we're starting to see the growth here. So the question really now is, this explosive growth that we're seeing in the pre-certs and the final certs, to what extent is that going to flow through to the tax returns? And a huge piece of that is this pass-through market and trying to gauge the demand side of that market. So getting to that, on the last page of the handout is a potential revenue impact from renewables. Now this is just the one piece, the renewables. So I was trying to focus on some of the law changes that were made in 2007. And so here we have two data streams, if you will. The lighter gray is kind of a base law, and that's what was in law before 2007. And the darker is kind of a revised revenue impact of the legislation in last year. And I had to make a number of assumptions here so the data wouldn't look like amounts, because all we really have are certs through 2007. It's an initial 2008, and that's where we have the spike. So what I assume for these numbers is that amount of certification doesn't actually represent a spike. It represents a new level of investment. So I assume the investment that happened in 2007 and the first part of 2008 is going to continue at that same level. And that really was just for presentation purposes here, and that's why in the outer years, 13, 14, and 15, that revenue impact levels out. To the extent that what we've seen this past year represents a spike, and if that really backs off in 08 and 09, then the revenue impact will be less. And at this point, I wouldn't rule out it continuing to grow at a very high rate as well. There's no limit to how much it can grow.
But these numbers don't reflect that.
No, I was...
That potential growth.
Correct. What I was trying to do here, the potential growth could be anywhere from what we've seen recently being just a spike. Mm-hmm. And so at the downside, that's the proper terminology, the investment over the next few years is going to be a lot less than we've seen the past year. At the other extreme, it can continue at the same rate of growth. And so what I was shooting for was on purpose something kind of in the middle, an expected value of a revenue impact, if you will, looking for kind of equally weighting the upside and the downside. And again, a really big unknown is the pass-through market. So I took the estimate from Energy of the pending that's out there and assumed that 50% of it would actually come to fruition on tax returns. Now that 50%, I chose it because it's in the middle. I mean, it could be that only 10%, that demand is such that only 10% get purchased and used, or it could be that 90% of it gets used. It's hard for me to to think that 90% that can actually be used. The volume of credits that are out there is so large, the liability, the demand side, the liability that's existing just doesn't seem that it can really meet the supply. Assuming that, for example, the price of the transfer doesn't change, that stays fixed, that it's stuck to the net present value. I was speaking to an accountant recently who was in the process of trying to market some of these, and that was one of the things he was hearing from some of his clients, is that they won't pay that price for it, but they might pay something less. Now, I don't think that's happening. I think that price is fixed right now, but that's another assumption within these numbers. That making sense?
I'm lost in tax credit land. Chris, if go back and remind me, and you probably said it and it went by early on in your presentation, the window that these companies have. Does it go away if they don't sell it, or does it stay out there on the market indefinitely until somebody buys it, or do you understand the question?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair. It's not indefinite because the credits expire. There's a sunset.
That's my question. When do they expire?
Well, the starting point is the year in which the project is completed. And so from 5 years there, so if the project was completed in 2007, the credit is taken over 5 years, so 79, 12. And then it can be an 8-year carry forward. So it's always so that's kind of the deadline. They have the 5-year time frame in which to use it. One thing that can happen is that you can have a taxpayer file an amended return. You can file an amended return for up to 3 years going back. So you can have a taxpayer who's trying to sell a credit for a project that was completed in 07 and say now it's 2009 and there aren't any takers. And then you have a taxpayer who realizes a large capital gains. They can then go in and buy that credit and file an amended return for old years and use it because they had the liability prior years and then they used it this year. I don't want to say gaming the system, but that's technically how it can work because you can file an amended return. That's kind of the intersecting. The filing an amended return has nothing to do with this credit per se. That's just the base law. But that's one way that taxpayers can use the credit as well.
Mr. Chair, I'm so glad I asked that question because it simplified things such.
Well, Dr. Lindenberger, you do have a way of getting to the heart of the issue. Thank you. I think I understand that answer, but I think in order to really understand it, I'd have to sit down and parse it very carefully, which is part of the reason why I wanted some of this material in writing and why you winced when I asked for it.
Oh, I'm not. Trying to figure out how I'd write that down.
Yeah.
If I could try to clarify, if there are some of these, there's this pot of credits out there in the supply there, and they've been there for a couple of years, and I'm a taxpayer. And looking forward, I'm going to buy the credit or an amount of the credit only to the extent that I am confident I'm going to have the liability over the 5 years.
Right.
So for taxpayers, and I'm thinking on the corporate side, that's highly volatile. There's less likelihood that a corporation is going to buy those credits because, as you know, corporation liability is up and down. On the individual side, it's a little more stable. Most of that stability, however, is from middle-income tax folks. And, you're a wage earner and you're earning $50,000 a year. And you have a steady job. You know what your liability is going to be. But your liability isn't going to be very large in terms of buying the credits to offset your tax. It's the high-end wage earner, the high-end income folks who have a lot of liability and are already working with CPAs who are telling them and notifying about these credits. There you have a case where perhaps their income is more volatile because it perhaps relies on capital gains. It's a bigger chunk of their income. So just looking forward, that 5-year time horizon is still pretty long in terms of knowing I'm going to have a liability of X, so I'm going to buy the credit and then just wipe out my liability. But what I could do is go back 2 years. So now I'm in year three. It's 2009. I can file an amended return for 08 and 07 and say I've had a tax liability of $1 million in 07. I had a really good 07, a really good 08, and a really good 09, and now I have $3 million of liability. And now my horizon looking forward is only 2 years. So now I can buy a credit, the appropriate credit, and go back and apply it to the 06, my 07, my 08, amended returns, my 09 return, and then my 10 and 11 returns. I don't know if that helped or not. I mean, it works.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask I think, probably overly simplistic question, and I'll just embarrass myself by it. The point of these credits, I believe, should be that we are encouraging growth in the area of renewables because we think it's the wave of the future, it's good for the economy, it's attracting these projects to Oregon where they might otherwise go somewhere else. And what seems complicated is you could sort of link the credit to those projects except for this whole secondary market aspect. And so I guess my question is, if the ultimate end user of these credits is, as you describe, a bunch of very well-to-do taxpayers, then we're also sort of setting policies here that ultimately benefit not the people or entities that we're trying to encourage. We're also giving tax benefits to well, just what I said. I guess I can't really articulate it any better than that. So is there, I mean, is that just the way it works in this market and there's nothing anybody can do about it?
Maybe I should answer. I can just answer just in terms of the justification or the rationale. Maybe Chris can add on kind of how it's worked. But, you know, I think there's a couple of things that come into play. One is to remember that, you know, you have your corporate taxes are based on net revenue. If you have companies that are relatively young or relatively new, they tend to not have a lot of net income. So if you want to give them something valuable, to make a credit transferable makes it more valuable to them. Much more valuable than if they were anticipating they'd have, you know, the next 4 or 5 years, they'd have a net loss, then the credit would do them a little good. The other point I wanted to bring up is some of this, and I remember this discussion in this committee in 2001 about this issue as well, that the change that we've gone through over the last 5 years to the sales-only apportionment formula really does change the liability of a lot of companies who have a large presence of property and payroll in the state, who may be making large investments to sell most of their products outside the state. They have little liability through that apportionment formula now. Therefore, credit, if you're thinking of it as a policy tool, becomes less effective unless you include this transferability. You know, I'm not saying that's the right policy decision, but that's the justification that's been used for making these credits transferable. And from the standpoint of the company that makes the investment, it clearly makes the credit much more valuable.
Yeah, because of course, and just to finish the thought, the idea is that the company that generated the credit in the first place may not get a reduced tax because they don't owe any taxes, but they do receive funds when they sell the credit from the taxpayer who actually does take the tax credit. That's to complete the thought. Representative Berger.
Yeah, and I'd like to get back up even further and sort of put on the table that it's my kind of understanding, and the changes in 07 were part of the fact that Oregon wants these kinds of manufacturing facilities for the jobs that they bring, for the good, high-paying jobs that with taxpayers, with citizens who have good jobs that didn't pay income tax into our system, and that's really what this policy is about, is trying to attract these kinds of good, high-paying, and particularly the 07 piece, the renewable manufacturing piece, to get and keep these jobs in Oregon. And if they start here, they stay here and they grow here. And so it's going after a specific market share, if you will, of a global market of companies that are doing these kinds of things. That's really what this Betsy was, as a policy piece, designed around. I just want to get that out before we get too much further lost in the jungle of transferable tax credits.
May I just simply comment on both of these, the question and comment, and that is that it seems to me that the committee needs to keep in mind that these are the reasons why we get involved in this stuff, and as we get into these very complex details, we always have to be able to refer back to Representative Rosenbaum's simple, simplistic question, which I don't consider to be simplistic at all, and Representative Berger's follow-up comment on that, because I think that as we look at the policy issues around the tax issues, we have to consider what it is we're trying to accomplish in the overall economy. Now, then that leads me to the next question, which I think comes directly from your comment, and that is this one, and I think I know the answer, but these numbers are based essentially on what we used to call a static analysis, are they not? They do not take into account the job growth, the taxes that a well-paid worker in one of the factories might make, or any of those kinds of offsets against this revenue loss, do they?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And that's, I think that's in reference to your comment. Please go ahead.
I was just about done, I think. I think I just done all the points. I don't know if I think I've muddied enough. So kind of that darker bar represents a revised revenue impact, if you will. And we have been talking with the state economist so that this should be incorporated in the forecast that you hear this Friday. And kind of the numbers that I'm looking at right now for the current biennium is that revenue impact. If you recall, this piece of 3201 had a revenue impact, 0709, of about $2 million and then about $13 million in 0911. That $2 million looks to be closer to about $8 million or $9 million, and that $13 million seems to be closer to about $30 million. Now, that's given all of the assumptions that I probably listed ad nauseum earlier.
And that's reflected in this chart?
That's reflected in this chart. That's that dark bar. If you sum up, this is kind of a collections basis, so if you sum up that dark part for each of the respective years, you can get a biennial number. And I'm still, the reason I didn't, I was just trying to present the information kind of in a visual way to try and try to attempt to convey it clearly. And then I'm still talking with Energy about getting updated information, and so I'm hoping to finalize that today and talk with the state economist about what those numbers would be. But the point of that was kind of the revised revenue impact, if you will, so that the Assembly is aware of the change.
Mr. Chair, just kind of a technical point, too, when you follow up on your point on the dynamic analysis. While we've made sure that the forecaster, state economist, has these numbers, he's also aware of the investments that are being proposed. And so that's built into the forecast as well. So we'll get both ends of that to the extent we can anticipate those effects.
So he actually does what amounts to a dynamic analysis, yes, in the process of determining the revenue forecast.
Yes. Representative Berger.
Yeah, with regard to this chart that we're looking on, the potential revenue impacts of renewables, if I could understand clearly your testimony here, Chris, what you've done here is take a sort of analysis of a middle, not upside downside, and see and run the numbers. You don't know if it's going to be up or down, so you don't know how accurate that is. So in looking at the actual numbers in millions, it's less useful than just looking at the curve of this chart, because you really don't know those numbers, because you don't know ups or downs.
That's correct, Madam Vice Chair, and that was the intent in trying to present it pictorially, if you will, because it's kind of the trend, if you will, and the numbers there, and there's a mix of people who, some people can look at numbers and it makes sense, there's always the conveying the information in terms of how people digest that. I was trying to go for, we're looking at a small, and it's potentially getting very big in outer years. is kind of the core message.
But the numbers themselves are not knowable to with any degree of accuracy at this point.
Madam Chair, there is a high degree of uncertainty about the numbers.
Thank you.
If I could just follow up on Chris's,
please.
That's certainly true that there's a wide range, but I think the other important point that Chris is making here is that we always have to make an estimate based on what we consider a midpoint estimate, and now we're saying that based on what we know now versus what we knew back last May and June when you considered that bill and approved it, we think that the midpoint estimate now is considerably higher.
Thank you.
That's the message we're trying to convey.
Thank you, Paul. That does put it in perspective.
One other comment that I wanted to make, and this is anecdotal based on my observations and probably inaccurate then, is that at least in the city where I live, there seems to be a much higher interest both in, simply on the retail end of the Betsy credit. And I think that there are people who are going to be out looking to whether they should put some photovoltaic cells on their residence roofs or on their warehouse roof as business than would have been the case a couple of years ago. I think part of it might be related to the fact that we changed the law to increase the potential credit, but I think part of it also is simply the increased interest in climate change issues and renewable issues, the kinds of things the governor has been pushing. And that's simply my observation. I don't know whether that's happening anywhere else in the state or not, but it doesn't surprise me at all that the projections we had last year are small compared to the projections we're making this year, and it has nothing to do with the accuracy of the projection. It has to do with the increase in public awareness of the system. One other observation that I would have, and I'm waiting to see if anyone else has a thought about these things, is that as we are moving toward moving the state economy from an economy based primarily on fossil fuels to an economy based to a much larger extent on renewable energy, there isn't any way of doing it without a substantial investment in both renewable energy devices, and then if we're fortunate enough to be able to get the cluster going in renewable manufacturing of renewable energy devices in Oregon, if we get into the business at the beginning, the odds of a long-term business in this cluster in Oregon in this area, I think, is significant, because we're talking about moving the world economy from basically based on fossil fuels to based on renewable energy systems over what I consider to be a pretty short period of time. The Industrial Revolution started in about 1830 in Great Britain, and we're now into the situation where we have to move from fossil fuel systems over to renewable energy, and we have to do it in a whole lot less than 190 years, 180 years. A whole lot less than that in order to make that shift. So there's going to be room for a large upside on the manufacturing side. And if we can grab a piece of that business for Oregon, it will be very valuable for the Oregon's economy for the next generation or two, in my view. And I think that's why the governor is so excited about this. What our job is going to be, if I can again add another comment to it, is not to overspend for what we need to spend in order to do this, because certainly business leaders, I think, understand the same thing I've just said, and they're going to be doing a good deal of this work whether we entice them to do it or not. Other comments?
Just one more question.
Yeah, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this would be for either Chris or Paul. The revocation of these credits, could you quickly explain to me, once they're sold, do we lose the ability then to exercise oversight to ensure that the projects for which they were applied actually are completed the way they're supposed to and create the jobs, et cetera?
$64 question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I believe that's correct. The director of the Department of Energy can revoke it if it has been obtained via fraud or misrepresentation. But once it's been transferred to a third party, somebody who has no stake in, who was not a player, if you will, in qualifying for the credit, I believe that cannot be revoked. I will double check that and get back to you on that, though.
And I realize it may be beyond the scope of what we can do now, but are there ways to continue to exercise that oversight and be able to make sure that the what we gave it for actually continues and happens?
Commissioner Rosenbaum, I believe that's definitely true. I've had some discussion in the context of another bill with counsel. Essentially, I mean, you can view the credit, and I'd like to get response from counsel on this, but review the credit as contractual obligation. Those the person that sells the credit that actually received it for carrying out the activity that was eligible for the credit would therefore assume the liability responsibility of carrying out what they had said they would do, and that it was not fraudulent. So that type of precaution to be taken, and we'll check on this in terms of exactly how it works now, because we have talked about it in context of some other
results. Thank you. And we're looking at possible drafting. I think Rep. Azeed may have a proposal in the area too. Thank you. Other questions or comments on this issue? Clear as mud, Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I was particularly struck by your comments and the comments by Vice Chair Berger and Paul about the importance of making these credits valuable to startups who don't have the revenue. And so I'm interested as we move forward in thinking about ways that might be advanced. Was struck by the 25% value being fixed and whether that might be something we can consider changing, and also interested in how I think, if I understood correctly, the credit is sold as a whole, entirely the entire 5-year period, and whether those might also be things to think about. So there's a lot here, and I appreciate the discussion.
Thank you. Looks like we have a work conference this week. Thank you very much, Paul.
Mr. Chair, we have some further background information for you on another topic. We're going to change. No, this one is our other difficult topic. So all the others are easy, though. So. I had some background information. Madison brought just the background information on the estate tax collections and kind of what we know. And the topic here is the estate tax, which we included in our information. And background material has a description of how the estate tax works. And it also has on the back of that the returns over the last 3 or 4 years. So that background information is there. What Madison and I have been doing is to look at some of the options you have been considering in response to the new the law change in 2007 on natural resource-based property. I'm talking about what was originally House Bill 3479. It became part of 3201. The database we have is not detailed in terms of the state level, in terms of the type of assets, but we have a lot of detailed information on the Internal Revenue Service. And what we have done is take that data and try to prepare some preliminary revenue impact estimates for you, and that's on a separate sheet that was with your material, and labeled preliminary revenue impact estimates. We tried to start off by just looking at what would be the maximum amount of revenue that could be affected by, for example, the complete exclusion of natural resource property
from the estate tax base. And if you look at our quarterly revenue forecast, we're projected to raise about $80 million a year through the estate tax. And that varies a lot, you know, and there's a lot of variability. You can see that in the data here, that occasionally we'll have a large number of returns come in. For example, in 2004, we had just 8 returns over $20 million, accounting for 2.7% of the total, whereas the prior year we had 11, accounting for 23%. So there's a huge variability there, depending on a large variety of states. But over time, we would we project about $80 million a year. So what we did to try to look at some revenue implications of proposals you're considering is to look at Internal Revenue Service data, which they do a pretty extensive analysis of estate taxes. And we had some broader definitions, but arrived at a conclusion about 5% of the estate tax base is in this resource type, natural resource type property, which would be commercial fishing and include agriculture and forestry. So if you were to say none of that property should be counted in terms of estate taxes, and this would be purely a static estimate, you'd reduce revenue by about $4 million a year in the long term. We're recognizing very good. So what we try to do from there is go back to various restrictions that you're looking at in terms of who uses that credit. And you can see on that sheet we've got credits of natural resource property. And you can see I try to define NR down below, and I'm already affected by our new location. This is not real sources. This is resources there. The first typo of the session. If, for example, you were to have a credit phased out starting at $7.5 million, as the LC that you introduced does, phases out to a value of property of $15 million, and said that each property had to have at least 25% of that estate in natural resource property, we're saying the long-term estimate would be about $2.8 million per year in revenue loss. And then so we've gone down, making that a stricter qualification, saying 50% of the estate and then 75% of the estate, which is how the LC was drafted that you recommended for introduction. So you would be excluding a number of estates because they would have resource property, but they wouldn't. It would be less than 75%. And this also would assume the kind of other restrictions you have in terms of material participation that are in the LC. And then so we're looking at an estimate of a little less than $1 million per year over time. Those revenue impacts are adjusted for collections lag. You have 9 months to file after a decedent passes away. You have an automatic 6-month extension from there. So there's going to be some lags between when this takes effect and when you see the revenue impact. And we try to build those in. And you can see under those three options what we would project to be the revenue impact of those proposals. And these estimates would replace the $1 million estimate that was assigned to the original law, which is 3201. Given the restrictions, particularly on forest product, on timber, on the trees, if there's some possible interpretation of the current law, it's very difficult to assess what that would be now at this point. Probably very restrictive and almost unusable at this point.
Okay.
Particularly in terms of those types of natural resource properties.
So are you saying it might be even lower than what you had originally estimated?
Could be, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So the point of the current law is there's a lot of ambiguity in it, and we're uncomfortable even assigning a revenue impact, but that's the $1 million that was in there now, and this gives you kind of a comparison of that table to show you some of the options that you've considered before we go into actual consideration of the bill.
So any of these options actually reduce our revenue estimate. I mean, reduce revenue. any of the options that we're looking at now.
Mr. Chair, the way the forecast is set up, we have $1 million in there in effect
right
now. So that those options in terms of our formal forecast process should be compared with the $1 million.
I see. So for example, the first box on the bottom, that minus 1.2, that would be an additional $200,000 cost.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Mazel?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mazel Malik, Legislative Revenue Office. Can you hear me now? It's good to see all of you. It's a new session on us, and it's a new vice chair and new member, Representative Benson. Good to see you. The information I passed to you, this is on the inheritance taxes, as we call it, and the way why we say it's an inheritance and an estate tax here in Oregon, because primarily we used to have an inheritance tax in Oregon. Now we have an estate tax, and the main difference that sometimes makes a confusion in what we are taxing at what point. The inheritance tax that we used to have, that we started in 1903, was, I wasn't around at that time.
I think Paul Warner was.
the 1903 session.
1903. Okay.
Sorry. We had the and it was a regular session then. that inheritance tax was basically based on the amount of inheritance passed to each individual. So we had the different rates going from 12% to 20% depending on the relationship that the individual is inheriting the amounts that they are. Of course, that started changing not only in Oregon, but it seems to be more of also around the nation, although some states still have it. In about 77, now Oregon started changing this. 78, we went to the complete federal pickup with the estate tax definition. So we went to the estate tax type of state, and that's primarily it is a tax on the right to transfer property at death, and generally is measured by the value of the estate at the time of passing. Now, after 1978, we transitioned outside of the inheritance tax for 10 years, and that started bringing down all inheritance tax on to about $8.9 million in that fiscal year in 88-89. But by then, we started attacking a lot of retirees and it became more of a destination Oregon, and the state tax started picking up from that point on. Now, the important thing I want to bring your attention to in this information that we have in front of you here is that the federal tax will completely basically collecting the what so-called the federal pickup. But that federal pickup is based on the law of the 1997 Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997. The federal law has changed in 2000 when it went to the what we call the ICTRA, or the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act. That's where the federal government, or the IRS, uses the definitions and amounts and levels for the estate tax. And what they did, in essence, they also put a number of reduction of the state shares of the pickup tax, and it became zero in the year 2005. So if we were 100% connected to that federal law in the year 2005, Oregon would have not collected any estate tax. So that's why in the 2003 session there was a decision by and primarily the revenue committee, I think at that time, is to not connect to the 2000 Act and stay at the 1997. So that represents a lot of confusion to a lot of people of where we are and why are we not at the levels we do. However, in order to remedy some of these issues, I think we moved up the level of where the exemption comes from the 40,000 at one point to the 1 million as we are today. So Oregon starts the exemption at 1 million. Of course, in the 2007 session, as Paul was mentioning at the beginning, we there was the attempt to through House Bill 3479, and later on it was folded into House Bill 3201, Section 68, is to give a reduction or an increase in the exemption, if you will, for the natural resource property defined as forest, farm, and commercial fishing, and push that level to 7.5 million. The restrictions, however, is what made our revenue impact at that time. This was small. We was seen as very restricted, very small, not to encompass hundreds. And as you see in the numbers that we have of the amounts of or the numbers of returns filed each year, we're talking about maximum of about 1,000. If we comply with the rest of the statistics, and is this coming out and in? So it's not. You can't hear me now. What is it? The one that I have to stay away from? I don't know. Clean room A, you have to stay 12 inches away to make the sound.
I think this mic requires you to be a little closer.
This one is the one that you need to be kissing it more. Is that working? You know, after the Betsy and the Match.com kind of thing, talking about the state Texas, I have to come up with a lot better.
Better material? Where's Slim Cheddarly when we need it?
Yeah. I was thinking the same thought.
That's right. And that's that thing I thought about Betsy is... What is the match with the match.com? Who else beats Betsy Tax? Kind of. That works. Okay, back to the thing. The ideas that started coming emerging out of this whole thing is whether this is an exclusion or an exemption. And just to remember back the issues that we're talking about with this 7.5 million. So, are we exempting? At 7.5 million, then we start back again and then have this cliff effect that everybody was starting to get concerned about. Or is it an exclusion where you shave off the 7.5 million to start with and you start from zero on? So these were the issues that started coming up. Was the intent of the policy is to preserve farm and forest land? Or was it farm and forest land owned by families, or family farm and forest land? Is it small business ownership? And about the entities and the definition of entities, which type of property, are there trees included? And all of these issues came as we are trying, or the Department of Revenue, when they started trying to put some rules to understand how they implement the new law that we've introduced. You've introduced. One of the things that the literature is always is basically talking about over and over again is if you have a policy, for example, that would want to reduce the pressure on farm land or forest land. Let's say that you introduce a policy that gives all farm and forest land up to 5.5 million only without any other restrictions, that kind of exemption. Although at the top, as we show in our table, you have about a limited 5%, 3.75. However, the unintended things that might consequences that might come out of the policy is the issue of starting to transfer by state planning and so on a lot of property that otherwise not forest and farm into forest and farm, which results in a lot of sense of pushing the prices up for the forest and farmland because that becomes needed or desired property, if you will. And in that sense, the policy becomes counter-effective that you, instead of preserving the land, you're actually pushing up the prices because otherwise it is exempt while the other property is not. So if that happens, for example, you would start losing more of the revenue that you would have otherwise got from other property because now it is just changing to a different style. So these issues are always connected with what you have in the 75% or 50% or where you choose your policy to be and what you're trying to accomplish. These are, I guess, the questions that we didn't answer or were left open at the time of the 2007 session. And now it's in your hands, I guess, to redefine and make these sharper points and edges of the policy clearer.
Thank you. Questions from Asim? Let me simply note that there is going to be a work group that I'll be working with to discuss these issues and others with the interested parties. If there are members of the committee who I haven't already contacted about it, who'd like to be involved in that, let me know. We're going to include the members of the House who expressed a strong interest in the area. Well, there are three of them at least. And if there's anybody else on the committee who'd like to be involved in that work group, we'll obviously keep it below a quorum of the committee, otherwise it wouldn't be a work group anymore. But if you're interested and you'd like to work on that, let me know. We're going to be working over the next couple of days, I think through Thursday evening, trying to pull the pieces together so we can actually present a final proposal to the committee on Monday. On that bill. Are there questions for Manson now as we finish up? We are at the end of our time for today, and I'd like to try to keep the committee time during the day at least to the times that we've been allocated by the House. Let me simply note that on our schedule, we expect a very interesting presentation from Solar World tomorrow, give us a little bit of a flavor of what the stakes are in dealing with the business energy tax credit. We may continue our conversation a bit on the estate tax, and then tomorrow night we'll go into a public hearing on the bills themselves. Anything else? If not, we're adjourned until tomorrow.